Their engines, as in Star Trek, may become a reality. They would utilize the greatest energy source in the universe, the direct conversion of matter into energy through matter and antimatter collisions. Antimatter is the opposite of matter, meaning that it has the opposite charge. An anti-electron has a positive charge, while an anti-proton has a negative charge. I tried to investigate antimatter in high school by placing a capsule of sodium-22, which emits anti-electrons, in a cloud chamber, and photographing the beautiful tracks left by the antimatter. Then I constructed a 2.3 million electron volt betatron particle accelerator in the hope of analyzing antimatter's properties. When matter and antimatter collide, both are annihilated into pure energy. So the reaction releases energy with 100% efficiency. A nuclear weapon, by contrast, is only 1% efficient. Most of the energy inside a hydrogen bomb is wasted. An antimatter rocket would be rather simple in design. The antimatter would be stored in secure containers and fed into a chamber in steady streams. It would combine explosively with ordinary matter in the chamber and result in a burst of gamma rays and X-rays. The energy would then be shot through an opening in the exhaust chamber to create thrust. As James Benford remarked to me, antimatter rockets are a favorite concept among science fiction fans. But there are serious problems with building them. For one, antimatter is naturally occurring, but only in relatively small quantities. So we would have to manufacture large amounts of it for use in engines. The first anti-hydrogen atom, with an anti-electron circling around an anti-proton, was created in 1995 at the European Organization for Nuclear Research, CERN, in Geneva, Switzerland. A beam of ordinary protons was produced and shot through a target made of ordinary matter. That collision resulted in a few particles of anti-protons. Huge magnetic fields separated the protons from the antiprotons by driving them in different directions, one bending to the right, the other to the left. The antiprotons were then slowed down and stored in a magnetic trap, where they were combined with antielectrons to form antihydrogen. In 2016, physicists at CERN took antihydrogen and analyzed the antielectron shells that orbit the antiproton. As expected, they found an exact correspondence between the energy levels of antihydrogen and ordinary hydrogen. CERN scientists have announced, if we could assemble all the antimatter we've ever made at CERN and annihilate it with matter, we would have enough energy to light a single electric light bulb for a few minutes. A whole lot more would be needed for a rocket. Also, antimatter is the most expensive form of matter in the world. At today's prices, a gram would go for about $70 trillion. Currently, it can only be created in very small amounts with particle accelerators, which are extremely costly to construct and operate. The Large Hadron Collider, LHC, at CERN, is the most powerful particle accelerator in the world, and costs more than $10 billion to set up. But it can only produce a very thin beam of antimatter. It would bankrupt the United States to accumulate enough to fuel a starship. The giant atom smashers of today are all-purpose machines, used purely as research tools, and are highly inefficient in their production of antimatter. One partial solution might be to establish factories specifically designed to churn it out. In that case, Harold Garish of NASA believes that the cost of antimatter could go down to $5 billion per gram. Storage presents another difficulty and expense. If you put antimatter in a bottle, sooner or later it would hit the walls of the bottle and annihilate the container. Penning traps would be needed to enclose it properly. These traps would use magnetic fields to hold atoms of antimatter in suspension and prevent them from coming into contact with the vessel. In science fiction, issues of cost and storage are sometimes eliminated by the discovery of a deus ex machina, an anti-asteroid that enables us to mine antimatter cheaply. But this hypothetical scenario raises a complicated question. Where does antimatter come from anyway? Everywhere we look in outer space with our instruments, we see matter, not antimatter. We know this because the collision of one electron with an anti-electron releases a minimum energy of 1.02 million electron volts. This is the fingerprint of an antimatter collision. But when we examine the universe, we detect very little of this type of radiation. Most of the universe we see around us is made of the same ordinary matter we are made of. Physicists believe that at the instant of the Big Bang, the universe was in perfect symmetry, and there was an equal amount of matter and antimatter. If so, the annihilation between the two would have been perfect and complete, and the universe should be made of pure radiation. Yet here we are, made of matter, which should not be around anymore. Our very existence defies modern physics. We have not yet figured out why there is more matter than antimatter in the universe. Only 1/10 billionth of the original matter in the early universe survived this explosion, and we are part of it. The leading theory is that something violated the perfect symmetry between matter and antimatter at the Big Bang, but we don't know what it is. There is a Nobel Prize waiting for the enterprising individual who can solve this problem. Antimatter engines are on the short list of priorities for anyone who wants to build a starship. But the properties of antimatter are still almost totally unexplored. It is not known, for example, whether it falls up or down. Modern physics predicts that it should fall down, like ordinary matter. If so, then anti-gravity would probably not be possible. However, this, along with so much else, has never been tested. Based on cost and our limited understanding, antimatter rockets will probably remain a dream for the next century, unless we happen upon an anti-asteroid drifting in space. Ramjet fusion starships. The ramjet fusion rocket is another enticing concept. It would look like a giant ice cream cone and would scoop up hydrogen gas in interstellar space, then concentrate it in a fusion reactor to generate energy. Like a jet or a cruise missile, the ramjet rocket would be quite economical. Because jets gulp ordinary air, they do not have to carry their own oxidizer, which reduces cost. Since there is an unlimited amount of hydrogen gas in space for fuel, the spaceship should be able to accelerate forever. As with the solar sail, the engine's specific impulse is infinite. The famous novel Dow Zero by Poul Anderson is about a ramjet fusion rocket that suffers a malfunction and cannot shut down. As it accelerates toward the speed of light, bizarre relativistic distortions begin to occur. Time slows down within the rocket, but the universe around it ages as usual. The faster it goes, the slower time beats inside it. To someone on the starship, however, things seem perfectly normal inside, while the universe outside ages rapidly. Eventually, the starship goes so fast that millions of years pass outside the ship as the crew members watch helplessly. After traveling uncounted billions of years into the future, the crew realizes that the universe is no longer expanding, but is actually shrinking. The expansion of the universe is finally reversing. The temperature soars as the galaxies begin to come together toward the final big crunch. At the end of the story, just as all the stars are collapsing, the rocket ship manages to skim past the cosmic fireball and witness a big bang as a new universe is born. As fantastic as this tale may be, its foundations do conform to Einstein's theory of relativity. Apocalyptic narratives aside, the ramjet fusion engine at first might seem too good to be true. But over the years, a number of possible criticisms have been leveled at it. The scoop might have to be hundreds of miles across, which would be both impractically large and prohibitively costly. The rate of fusion might not produce enough energy to sustain a starship. Dr. James Benson also pointed out to me that our sector of the solar system does not contain enough hydrogen to feed the engines, though perhaps other areas of the galaxy might. Others claim that the drag on a ramjet engine as it moves in the solar wind would exceed its thrust, so it can never reach relativistic velocities. Physicists have tried to modify the design to rectify these disadvantages, but we have a long way to go before ramjet rockets become a realistic option. Problems with starships. It should be emphasized that all the starships mentioned so far face other problems associated with traveling near light speed. Asteroid collisions would present a major risk, and even tiny asteroids could pierce the hull of the ship. As we mentioned, the space shuttle suffered small nicks and scars from cosmic debris, which probably hit the spacecraft near orbiting velocity, or 18,000 miles per hour. Near light speed, however, impacts will take place at many times that velocity, potentially pulverizing the starship. In the movies, this hazard is eliminated by powerful force fields that conveniently repel all these micrometeorites. But those, unfortunately, only exist in the minds of science fiction writers. In reality, electric and magnetic force fields can indeed be generated, but even household objects that are not charged, such as plastic, wood, and plaster, could easily penetrate them. In outer space, tiny micrometeorites, because they are uncharged, cannot be deflected by electric and magnetic fields, and gravitational fields are attractive and extremely weak, so they would not be suitable for the repulsive force fields we would need. Braking is another challenge. If you are zipping through space at a velocity approaching light speed, how do you slow down when you reach your destination? Solar and laser sails depend on the energy of the sun or banks of laser beams, which cannot be used to decelerate the starship. So they may be useful mainly in flyby missions. Perhaps the best way to brake nuclear rockets is to turn them around 180 degrees so the thrust is in the opposite direction. However, this strategy would consume roughly half the mission's thrust to reach the targeted velocity and the other half to slow the rocket down. For solar sails, perhaps the sail can be reversed so that light from the star at the destination can be used to slow down the spacecraft. Another issue is that most of these starships capable of carrying astronauts would be hefty and could only be assembled in outer space. Scores of space missions would be required to send the building materials into orbit and still more to assemble the pieces. To avoid insurmountable expenses, a more economical method of launching missions into space must be devised. That is where the space elevator may come in. Elevators into space. Space elevators would be a game-changing application of nanotechnology. A space elevator is a long shaft that stretches from the Earth into outer space. You would enter the elevator, press the up button, and then be rapidly lifted into orbit. You wouldn't suffer the crushing G-forces experienced when a booster rocket blasts off its launch pad. Instead, your ride into space would be as mild as taking the elevator to the top of a department store. Like Jack's Beanstalk, the space elevator would seemingly defy gravity and provide an effortless way to ascend into the skies. The possibility of a space elevator was first explored by the Russian physicist Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, who was intrigued by the building of the Eiffel Tower in the 1880s. If engineers could build such a magnificent structure, he asked himself, why not keep going and extend one into outer space? Using simple physics, he was able to show that, in principle, if the tower was long enough, then centrifugal force would be sufficient to keep it upright, without any external force. Just as a ball on a string does not fall to the floor because of its spin, a space elevator would be kept from collapsing by the centrifugal force of the spinning Earth. The notion that perhaps rockets were not the only way to enter space was radical and exciting. But there was an immediate roadblock. The stress on space elevator cables might reach 100 gigapascals of tension, which exceeds the breaking point of steel, which is 2 gigapascals. Steel cables would snap, and the space elevator would come tumbling down. The concept of space elevators was shelved for almost 100 years. They were mentioned occasionally by authors like Arthur C. Clarke, who featured them in a novel called The Fountains of Paradise. However, asked when a space elevator might be possible, he replied, "Probably about 50 years after everyone stops laughing." But no one is laughing anymore. Suddenly, space elevators don't seem so far-fetched after all. In 1999, a preliminary NASA study assessed that an elevator with a cable 3 feet wide and 30,000 miles long could transport 15 tons of payload. In 2013, the International Academy of Astronautics issued a 350-page report projecting that with enough funding and research, a space elevator capable of carrying multiple 20-ton payloads might be possible by 2035. Price estimates usually range from $10 billion to $50 billion, a fraction of the $150 billion that went into the International Space Station. Meanwhile, space elevators could reduce the cost of putting payloads into space by a factor of 20. The problem is no longer one of basic physics, but of engineering. Serious calculations are now being made to determine whether space elevator cables could be made of pure carbon nanotubes, which are so strong that they would not break. But can we make enough of these nanotubes to stretch thousands of miles into space? At present, the answer is no. Pure carbon nanotubes are extremely difficult to manufacture beyond a centimeter or so. You might hear announcements that nanotubes many feet long have been constructed, but those materials are actually composites. They consist of tiny threads of pure carbon nanotubes compressed into a fiber and lose the wondrous properties of pure nanotubes. To stimulate interest in projects like the space elevator, NASA sponsors the Centennial Challenges Program, which awards prizes to amateurs who can invent advanced technologies for the space program. It once held a contest calling for entrants to submit components for a mini elevator prototype. I participated in it for a TV special I hosted, following a group of young engineers who were convinced that space elevators would open up the heavens to the average person. I watched as they used laser beams to send a small capsule up a long cable. Our TV special tried to capture the enthusiasm of this new class of entrepreneurial engineers, keen to build the future. Space elevators would revolutionize our access to outer space, which, instead of remaining the exclusive territory of astronauts and military pilots, could become a playground for children and families. They would offer an efficient new approach to space travel and industry and make possible the extraterrestrial assembly of complex machinery, including starships, that can travel almost as fast as light. But realistically, given the enormous engineering problems facing us, a space elevator might not be possible until late in this century. Of course, considering our restless curiosity and ambition as a species, we will eventually move on beyond fusion and antimatter rockets and face the greatest challenge of all. There is the possibility that one day we might break the ultimate speed limit in the universe, the speed of light. Warp drive. One day, a boy read a children's book and changed world history. It was 1895, and cities were beginning to be wired up for electricity. To understand this strange new phenomenon, the boy picked up popular books on natural science by Aaron Bernstein. In it, the author asked readers to imagine riding alongside an electric current inside a telegraph wire. The boy then wondered what it would be like if you replaced the electric current with a beam of light. Can you outrace light? He reasoned that since light was a wave, the light beam would look stationary, frozen in time. But even at the age of 16, he grasped that no one had ever seen a stationary wave of light. He spent the next 10 years puzzling over this question. Finally, in 1905, he found the answer. His name was Albert Einstein, and his theory was called special relativity. He discovered that you cannot outrace a light beam, because the speed of light is the ultimate velocity in the universe. If you approach it, strange things happen. Your rocket becomes heavier, and time slows down inside it. If you were to somehow reach light speed, you would be infinitely heavy, and time would stop. Both conditions are impossible, which means you cannot break the light barrier. Einstein became the cop on the block, setting the ultimate speed limit in the universe. This barrier has bedeviled generations of rocket scientists ever since. But Einstein was not satisfied. Relativity could explain many of the mysteries of light, but he wanted to apply his theory to gravity as well. In 1915, he came up with an astonishing explanation. He postulated that space and time, which were once thought to be inert and static, were actually dynamic, like smooth bedsheets that can be bent, stretched, or curved. According to his hypothesis, the Earth does not revolve around the Sun because it is pulled by the Sun's gravity, but because the Sun warps the space around it. The fabric of space-time pushes on the Earth so that it moves in a curved path around the Sun. Simply put, gravity does not pull. Instead, space pushes. Shakespeare once said that all the world is a stage, and we are actors making our entrances and exits. Picture space-time as an arena. It was once thought to be static, flat, and absolute, with clocks ticking at the same rate across the surface. But in the Einsteinian universe, the stage can be warped. Clocks run at different rates. Actors cannot walk across the stage without falling over. They might claim that an invisible force is pulling them in various directions, when actually the warped stage is pushing them. Einstein also realized that there was a loophole in his general theory of relativity. The larger a star is, the greater the warping of space-time surrounding it. If a star is heavy enough, it becomes a black hole. The fabric of space-time may actually tear, potentially creating a wormhole, which is a gateway or shortcut through space. This concept, first introduced by Einstein and his student Nathan Rosen in 1935, is today called the Einstein-Rosen Bridge. Wormholes. The simplest example of an Einstein-Rosen bridge is the looking glass from Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. On one side of the looking glass is the countryside of Oxford, England. On the other side is the fantasy world of Wonderland, to which Alice is instantly transported when she puts her finger through the glass. Wormholes are a favorite plot device in the movies. Han Solo sends the Millennium Falcon through hyperspace by propelling it through a wormhole. The refrigerator that Sigourney Weaver's character opens in Ghostbusters is a wormhole through which she peers at an entire universe. In C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the wardrobe is the wormhole connecting the English countryside to Narnia. Wormholes were discovered by analyzing the mathematics of black holes, which are collapsed giant stars whose gravity is so intense that even light cannot escape. Their escape velocity is the speed of light. In the past, black holes were thought to be stationary and to have infinite gravity, called a singularity. But all the black holes that have been recorded in space are spinning quite rapidly. In 1963, physicist Roy Kerr discovered that a spinning black hole, if it was moving fast enough, would not necessarily collapse to a pinpoint, but to a spinning ring. The ring is stable because centrifugal force prevents it from collapsing. So where does everything that falls into a black hole go? Physicists do not yet know. But one possibility is that matter can emerge from the other side through what is called a white hole. Scientists have looked for white holes, which would release matter rather than swallow it up, but have not found any so far. If you approached the spinning ring of a black hole, you would witness incredible distortions of space and time. You might see light beams captured billions of years ago by the wormhole's gravity. You might even meet copies of yourself. Your atoms might be stretched by tidal forces in a disturbing and lethal process called spaghettification. If you entered the ring itself, you might be expelled through a white hole in a parallel universe on the other side. Imagine taking two sheets of paper, held parallel to each other, then drilling a hole through them with a pencil to connect them. If you traveled along the pencil, you would pass between two parallel universes. However, if you passed through the ring a second time, you would arrive at another parallel universe. Each time you went into the ring, you would reach a different universe. In the same way that entering an elevator allows you to move between different floors of an apartment building. Except in this case, you could never return to the same floor. Gravity would be finite as you entered the ring, so you would not necessarily be crushed to death. However, if the ring was not spinning fast enough, it could still collapse on you and kill you. But it may be possible to stabilize the ring artificially by adding something called negative matter or negative energy. A stable wormhole is therefore a balancing act, and the key is to maintain the right mixture of positive and negative energy. You need lots of positive energy to naturally create the gateway between universes, as with a black hole. But you also need to create negative matter or energy artificially to keep the gateway open and prevent a collapse. Negative matter is quite different from antimatter and has never been detected in nature. Negative matter has bizarre anti-gravitational properties, meaning that it would fall up rather than down. By contrast, antimatter is theorized to fall down, not up. If it existed on the Earth billions of years ago, it would have been repelled by the matter of the planet and would have floated into outer space. Perhaps that's why we haven't found any. Although physicists have seen no evidence of negative matter, negative energy has actually been created in the laboratory. This keeps alive the hope of science fiction fans who dream of one day traveling through wormholes to distant stars. However, the amount of negative energy that has been created in the laboratory is minuscule, far too small to drive a starship. To create enough negative energy to stabilize a wormhole would require an extremely advanced technology, which we will discuss in more detail in Chapter 13. So, for the foreseeable future, hyperdrive wormhole starships are beyond our capability. But recently, there has been some excitement generated by another means to warp space-time. Alcubierre Drive. In addition to wormholes, the Alcubierre engine might offer a second way to break the light barrier. I once interviewed the Mexican theoretical physicist Miguel Alcubierre. He was struck with a groundbreaking idea in relativistic physics while watching TV. Perhaps the first time this has ever happened. During an episode of Star Trek, he marveled that the starship Enterprise could travel faster than light. It could somehow compress the space in front of it so that the stars did not seem as distant. The Enterprise did not journey to the stars. The stars came to the Enterprise. Think of moving across a carpet to reach a table. The common sense way is to walk along the carpet from one point to another. But there is another way. One could rope the table and drag it toward you, so that you are compressing the carpet. So instead of walking across the carpet to reach the table, the carpet folds up and the table comes to you. An interesting realization dawned on him. Usually, you start with a star or planet and then use Einstein's equations to calculate the bending of space around it. But you can also go backward. You can identify a particular warping and use the same equations to determine the type of star or planet that would cause it. A rough analogy might be made to the way an auto mechanic builds a car. You could begin with the parts that are available, the engine, the tires, and whatnot, and assemble a car from them. Or you could select the design of your dreams and then figure out the parts necessary to create it. Alcubierre turned Einstein's math on its head, reversing the usual logic of theoretical physicists. He attempted to gauge what kind of star might compress space in the forward direction and expand it in the backward direction. Much to his shock, he reached a very simple answer. It turned out that the space warp used in Star Trek was an allowed solution of Einstein's equations. Perhaps warp drive was not so improbable after all. A starship equipped with Alcubierre drive would have to be surrounded by a warp bubble, a hollow bubble of matter and energy. Space-time inside and outside the bubble would be disconnected. As the starship accelerated, people inside it would feel nothing. They might not think that the ship was moving at all, even though they would be traveling faster than light. Alcubierre's result shocked the physics community, because it was so novel and radical. But after his paper was published, critics began to point to its weak spots. Although its vision for faster-than-light travel was elegant, it did not address all the complications. If the region inside the starship is separated from the outside world by the bubble, information would not be able to get through, and the pilot would not be able to control the direction of the ship. Steering would be impossible. And then there's the issue of actually creating a warp bubble. In order to compress the space in front of it, it would have to have a certain kind of fuel, that is, negative matter or energy. We are right back to where we started. Negative matter or negative energy would be the missing ingredient needed to keep our warp bubbles, as well as our wormholes, intact. Stephen Hawking has proven a general theorem stating that all solutions of Einstein's equations that allow faster-than-light travel must involve negative matter or energy. In other words, positive matter and energy that we see in stars can warp space-time so that it perfectly describes the motion of heavenly bodies. But negative matter and energy warp space-time in bizarre ways, creating an anti-gravitational force that can stabilize wormholes and prevent them from collapsing and propel warp bubbles to faster-than-light velocities by compressing space-time in front of them. Physicists then tried to calculate the amount of negative matter or energy necessary to propel a starship. The latest results indicate that the amount required is equivalent to the mass of the planet Jupiter. This means that only a very advanced civilization will be able to use negative matter or energy to propel their starships, if it is possible at all. However, it is possible that the amount of negative matter or energy necessary to go faster than light could drop, because the calculations depend on the geometry and size of the warp bubble or wormhole. Star Trek gets around this inconvenient hurdle by postulating that a rare mineral called the dilithium crystal is the essential component of a warp drive engine. Now we know that dilithium crystals may be a fancy way of saying negative matter or energy. Casimir effect and negative energy. Dilithium crystals do not exist, but tantalizingly, negative energy does, leaving open the possibility of wormholes, compressed space, and even time machines. Although Newton's laws do not allow negative energy, quantum theory does through the Casimir effect, which was proposed in 1948 and measured in the laboratory in 1997. Say that we have two parallel metal plates that are uncharged. When they are separated by a large distance, we say that there is zero electrical force between them. But as they get closer, they mysteriously begin to attract each other. We can then extract energy from them. Since we start with zero energy, but obtain positive energy when the plates are brought together, it follows that the plates themselves originally had negative energy. The reason is rather esoteric. Common sense tells us that a vacuum is a state of emptiness, with zero energy. But actually, it is teeming with matter and antimatter particles that materialize briefly out of the vacuum and then annihilate back into it. These virtual particles appear and disappear so rapidly that they do not violate the conservation of matter and energy. That is, the principle that the total amount of matter and energy in the universe always remains the same. This constant churning in the vacuum creates pressure. Since there is more matter and antimatter activity outside the plates than between them, this pressure pushes the plates together, creating negative energy. This is the Casimir effect, which in quantum theory demonstrates that negative energy can exist. Originally, because the Casimir is such a tiny force, it could only be measured with the most sensitive equipment available. But nanotechnology has advanced to the point at which we can tinker with individual atoms. For a TV special I once hosted, I visited a laboratory at Harvard that had a small tabletop device that could manipulate atoms. In the experiment I observed, it was difficult to prevent two atoms that have been brought close to each other from flying apart or coming together due to the Casimir force, which can be either repulsive or attractive. Negative energy may seem like the holy grail to a physicist building a starship. But for a nanotechnologist, the Casimir force is so strong at the atomic level that it becomes a nuisance. In conclusion, negative energy does exist. And if enough negative energy could somehow be collected, we could, in principle, create a wormhole machine or a warp drive engine, fulfilling some of the wildest fantasies of science fiction. But these technologies are still a long way off, and will be discussed in chapters 13 and 14. In the meantime, we will make do with the light sails that might be zooming through space by the end of the century, offering the first close-up pictures of exoplanets orbiting other stars. By the 22nd century, we may be able to visit these planets ourselves on fusion rockets. And if we can solve the intricate engineering problems in front of us, we may even be able to make antimatter engines, ramjet engines, and space elevators a reality. Once we have starships, what will we find in deep space? Will there be other worlds that can sustain humanity? Fortunately, our space telescopes and satellites have given us a detailed look at what lurks among the stars. Hence, I say that I have not merely the opinion, but the strong belief, on the correctness of which I would stake even many of the advantages of life, that there are inhabitants in other worlds. Immanuel Kant. The desire to know something of our neighbors in the immense depths of space does not spring from idle curiosity, nor from thirst for knowledge, but from a deeper cause, and it is a feeling firmly rooted in the heart of every human being capable of thinking at all. Nikola Tesla. Chapter 9. Kepler and a Universe of Planets. Every few days, Giordano Bruno has his revenge. Bruno, Galileo's predecessor, was burned alive at the stake for heresy in Rome in 1600. The stars in the heavens are so numerous, he observed, that our sun must be one of many. Surely these other stars, too, are orbited by a multitude of planets, some of which may even be inhabited by other beings. The church imprisoned him for 7 years without trial, then stripped him naked, paraded him through the streets of Rome, tied his tongue with a leather strap, and lashed him to a wooden pillar. He was given one last chance to recant, but he refused to take back his ideas. To squelch his legacy, the church placed all his texts on the Index of Forbidden Books. Unlike Galileo's works, Bruno's were banned until 1966. Galileo merely claimed that the sun, not the earth, was the center of the universe. Bruno suggested that the universe had no center at all. He was one of the first in history to posit that the universe might be infinite, in which case the earth would be just another pebble in the sky. The church could no longer claim to be the center of the universe, because it had none. In 1584, Bruno summed up his philosophy, writing, "This space we declare to be infinite In it are an infinity of worlds of the same kind as our own. Now, more than 400 years later, roughly 4,000 extrasolar planets in the Milky Way have been documented, and the list grows almost daily. In 2017, NASA listed 4,496 candidate planets, of which 2,330 have been confirmed, discovered by the Kepler spacecraft. If you go to Rome, you might want to visit the Campo dei Fiori, the Plain of Flowers, where there is an imposing statue of Bruno on the very spot where he faced his death. When I went, I found a bustling square full of shoppers, who may not all have been aware that the location had been an execution site for heretics. But Bruno's statue itself gazes down upon a number of young rebels, artists, and street musicians who, unsurprisingly, congregate there. While taking in this peaceful scene, I wondered what kind of atmosphere could have existed back in Bruno's day to inflame such a murderous mob. How could they be whipped up to torture and kill a vagabond philosopher? Bruno's ideas languished for centuries, because finding an extrasolar planet is exceedingly difficult and was once thought to be nearly impossible. Planets do not give off light of their own. Even the reflected light of one is about a billion times dimmer than that of the mother star, the harsh glare of which can obscure the planet from view. But thanks to the giant telescopes and space-based detectors we have today, a flood of recent data has proven Bruno to be correct. Is our solar system average? In my childhood, I read an astronomy book that changed the way I understood the universe. After describing the planets, the book concluded that our solar system was probably a typical one, echoing the ideas of Bruno. But it also went much further. It speculated that planets in other solar systems moved in almost perfect circles around their sun, like ours. The ones closer to the sun were rocky, while the ones farther out were gas giants. Our sun was the average Joe of stars. The notion that we live in a quiet, ordinary suburb of the galaxy was simple and comforting. But boy, were we wrong. We now realize that we are the oddballs, and that the arrangement of our solar system, with its orderly sequence of planets and near-circular orbits, is rare in the Milky Way. As we begin to explore other stars, we are coming across solar systems cataloged in the Extrasolar Planets Encyclopedia that are radically different from our own. One day, this encyclopedia of planets may contain our future home. Sarah Seeger, professor of planetary science at MIT and one of Time magazine's 25 most influential figures in space exploration, is a key astronomer behind this encyclopedia. I asked her whether she was interested in science as a child. She admitted to me that actually she was not, but the moon did catch her attention. She was intrigued by the fact that it seemed to follow her whenever her father drove her around. How could something so far away appear to chase after her car? The illusion is caused by parallax. We judge distances by moving our heads. Close objects like trees seem to shift the most, while distant entities, like the mountains, do not change position at all. But objects immediately next to us that are moving with us also don't appear to change position. Our brains therefore confuse remote objects, like the moon, with adjacent ones, like the steering wheel in the car, and make us think that both are moving consistently alongside us. As a result of parallax, many of the UFOs spotted trailing after our cars are actually sightings of the planet Venus. Professor Seeger's fascination with the heavens blossomed into a lifelong romance. Parents sometimes buy telescopes for their inquisitive children, but she bought her own first telescope with the money she earned from a summer job. She remembers being 15 and excitedly talking to two of her friends about an exploding star, named Supernova 1987A, that had just been seen in the sky. It had made history as the closest supernova since 1604, and she was planning to go to a party to celebrate the rare event. Her friends, however, were baffled. They did not know what she was talking about. Professor Seeger went on to convert her enthusiasm and sense of wonder about the universe into a bright career in exoplanet science, a discipline that didn't exist 2 decades ago, but that is one of the hottest fields in astronomy today. Methods to find exoplanets. It is not easy to see exoplanets directly, so astronomers find them with a variety of indirect strategies. Professor Seeger stressed to me that astronomers are confident of their results because they detect exoplanets in multiple ways. One of the most popular is called the transit method. Sometimes, when analyzing the intensity of starlight, you notice that it weakens periodically. This dimming is a small effect, but indicates the presence of a planet that, from the vantage point of Earth, has moved in front of its mother star, thereby absorbing some of its light. Since the path of the planet can therefore be tracked, its orbital parameters can be calculated. A Jupiter-sized planet would reduce light from a star like our Sun by about 1%. For an Earth-like planet, the figure is 0.008%. This is like the dimming of a car's headlight if a mosquito passes by it. Fortunately, as Professor Seeger explained, our instruments are so sensitive and accurate that they can pick up on the slightest changes in luminosity from multiple planets and prove the existence of entire solar systems. However, not all exoplanets move in front of a star. Some have tilted orbits, and therefore cannot be observed by the transit method. Another popular approach is the radial velocity, or Doppler method, in which astronomers look for a star that seems to move back and forth regularly. If there is a large Jupiter-sized planet orbiting the star, then the star and its Jupiter are actually orbiting each other. Think of a rotating dumbbell. The two weights, representing the mother star and its Jupiter, turn around a common center. The Jupiter-sized planet is invisible from a distance, but the mother star can clearly be seen moving in a mathematically precise fashion. The Doppler method can be used to calculate its velocity. For example, if a yellow star moves toward us, the light waves are compressed like an accordion, so the yellow light turns slightly bluish. If it moves away from us, its light is stretched and turns reddish. The speed of the star can be determined by analyzing how much the light frequency changes as the star moves toward and away from the detector. This is similar to what happens when the police shine a laser beam on your car. The changes in the reflected laser light can be used to measure how fast you are going. Careful examination of the mother star over weeks and months also enables scientists to estimate the mass of the planet using Newton's law of gravity. The Doppler method is tedious, but it led to the discovery of the first exoplanet in 1992, which set off a stampede of ambitious astronomers trying to track down the next one. Jupiter-sized planets were the earliest to be observed because giant objects correspond to the largest movements of the mother star. The transit method and Doppler method are the two main techniques for locating extrasolar planets, but a few others have been introduced recently. One is direct observation, which, as previously mentioned, is difficult to accomplish. However, Professor Seeger is excited by NASA's plans to develop space probes that can carefully and precisely obstruct the light from the mother star, which might otherwise overwhelm the planet. Gravitational lensing may be a promising alternate method, although it only works if there is perfect alignment between the Earth, the exoplanet, and the mother star. We know from Einstein's theory of gravity that light can bend as it moves near a celestial body, because a large mass can alter the fabric of space-time around it. Even if the object is not visible to us, it will change the trajectory of light, just as clear glass does. If a planet moves directly in front of a distant star, the light will be distorted into a ring. This particular pattern is called an Einstein ring, and signals the presence of a substantial mass between the observer and the star. Results from Kepler. A big breakthrough came with the 2009 launch of the Kepler spacecraft, which was specifically designed to find extrasolar planets by employing the transit method. It was successful beyond the wildest dreams of the astronomical community. Next to the Hubble Space Telescope, the Kepler spacecraft is probably the most productive space satellite of all time. It is a marvel of engineering, weighing 2,300 pounds with a massive 4.6-foot mirror and bristling with the latest high-tech sensors. Because it has to stare at the same spot in the sky for long periods of time in order to get the best data, it does not orbit the Earth, but circles the Sun instead. From its perch in deep space, which can be 100 million miles from Earth, it uses a series of gyroscopes to focus on 1/400th of the sky, a small patch in the direction of the constellation Cygnus. Inside that tiny field of vision, Kepler has analyzed about 200,000 stars and uncovered thousands of extrasolar planets. It has forced scientists to reevaluate our position in the universe. Instead of locating other solar systems resembling our own, astronomers came across something totally unexpected. Planets of all sizes orbiting stars at all distances. There are planets out there that have no counterpart in our solar system, some of which are in between the size of the Earth and Neptune, or much smaller than Mercury, Professor Seeger reflected. But today, we still haven't found any copies of our solar system. In fact, there have been so many strange results that astronomers don't have enough theories to accommodate them. The more we find, the less we understand, she confessed. The whole thing is a mess. We are at a loss to explain even the most common of these exoplanets. Many of the Jupiter-sized planets, which have been the easiest to find, are not moving in near circular trajectories as expected, but in highly elliptical orbits. Some Jupiter-sized planets are in circular orbits, but they are so close to the mother star that if they were in our solar system, they would be within the orbit of Mercury. These gas giants are called hot Jupiters, and the solar wind is constantly blowing their atmosphere into outer space. But astronomers once believed that Jupiter-sized planets originate in deep space, billions of miles from the mother star. If so, how did they get so close? Professor Seeger admits that astronomers don't know for sure, but the most probable answer took them by surprise. One theory states that all gas giants form in the outer regions of a solar system, where there is plenty of ice around which hydrogen and helium gas and dust can collect. But in some cases, there is also a large amount of dust spread out within the plane of the solar system. The gas giant may gradually lose energy from the friction of moving through the dust, entering into a death spiral toward the mother star. This explanation introduced the heretical idea of migrating planets, which had been previously unheard of. As they edge closer to their suns, they might cross the path of a small Earth-like planet and fling it into outer space. That smaller rocky planet might become a rogue planet, drifting alone in outer space, independent of any star. So we don't expect any Earth-like planets in a solar system with Jupiter-sized planets in highly elliptical orbits or orbits near the mother star. In hindsight, these strange results should have been anticipated. Because our own solar system has planets moving in nice circles, astronomers naturally assumed that the balls of dust and hydrogen and helium gas that become solar systems condensed evenly. We now realize that it is more likely that gravity compresses them in a haphazard, random way, resulting in planets that move in elliptical or irregular orbits that may intersect or collide with one another. This is important, because it may be that only solar systems with circular planetary orbits like ours are conducive to life. Earth-sized planets. Earth-like planets are small, and hence cause faint dimming or subtle distortions of light from the mother sun. But with the Kepler spacecraft and giant telescopes, astronomers have begun to locate super-Earths, which, like Earth, are rocky and capable of sustaining life as we know it, but are 50% to 100% larger than our planet. We cannot yet account for their origin. But in 2016 and 2017, a series of sensational headline-grabbing discoveries about them were made. Proxima Centauri is the closest star after our Sun to the Earth. It is actually part of a triple star system and orbits a pair of larger stars called Alpha Centauri A and B, which orbit each other. Astronomers were stunned to come across a planet just 30% larger than the Earth moving around Proxima Centauri. They named it Proxima Centauri B. This is a game changer in exoplanetary science, declared Rory Barnes, an astronomer at the University of Washington in Seattle. The fact that it's so close means we have the opportunity to follow up on it better than any other planet discovered so far. The next batch of giant telescopes in development, like the James Webb Space Telescope, might be able to capture the first photograph of the planet. As Professor Seeger put it, it's absolutely phenomenal. Who would have thought that after all these years of wondering about planets, that there's one around our nearest star? Proxima Centauri B's mother star is a dim red dwarf, only 12% as massive as the Sun. So the planet must be relatively close to the star in order to be inside its habitable zone, where it can support liquid water and possibly even oceans. The radius of the planet's orbit is just 5% of the radius of the Earth's orbit around the Sun. It also revolves around its mother star much faster, making one complete revolution every 11.2 days. There is intense speculation about whether Proxima Centauri B has conditions compatible with life as we know it. One major concern is that the planet might be bombarded by solar winds, which could be 2,000 times more intense than those hitting the Earth. To shield itself against these blasts, Proxima Centauri B would have to have a strong magnetic field. At present, we do not have enough information to determine whether this is the case. It has also been suggested that Proxima Centauri B may be tidally locked, so that, like our own moon, one side always faces the star. That side would be perpetually hot, while the other side would be permanently cold. Liquid water oceans might then occur only at the narrow band between these two hemispheres, where the temperature is moderate. However, if the planet has a dense enough atmosphere, the winds might equalize the temperatures so that liquid oceans could exist freely across its surface. The next step is to determine the composition of the atmosphere and whether it contains water or oxygen. Proxima Centauri B was detected using the Doppler method. But the chemical composition of its atmosphere is best assessed with the transit method. When an exoplanet crosses directly in front of the mother star, a tiny sliver of light passes through its atmosphere. Molecules of certain substances in the atmosphere absorb specific wavelengths of starlight, allowing scientists to determine the nature of those molecules. However, for this to work, the orientation of the exoplanet's path must be just right, and there is only a 1.5% chance that Proxima Centauri B's orbit is aligned correctly. It would be an astonishing coup to find molecules of water vapor on an Earth-like planet. Professor Seeger explained that if you have a small rocky planet, you can only have water vapor if you also have liquid water on its surface. So if we find water vapor on a rocky planet, we can infer that it also has liquid oceans. 7 Earth-sized planets around one star. Another unprecedented finding came in 2017. Astronomers located a solar system that violated all the theories of planetary evolution. It contained 7 Earth-sized planets orbiting a mother star called TRAPPIST-1. 3 of the planets are in the Goldilocks zone and may have oceans. This is an amazing planetary system, not only because we have found so many planets, but because they are all similar in size to the Earth, said Michel Gillon.